Hello everyone, my name is Michel. Thank you very much for joining us today. I'm delighted to host Professor Christine Klein, who will be talking to us about the importance of genetics in finding a cure for Parkinson's. Professor Klein is Professor of Neurology and Neurogenetics at the University of Lübeck in Germany, and she's a world leader in this area. Actually, I had the pleasure of listening to her at the Barcelona conference last year. As always, before we start, I would like to remind everyone that this session is for information and education purposes only. You know that if you are seeking medical advice, this is not the right place. Please make sure that you consult a medical professional. So there will be time, obviously, for questions at the end of this presentation. You can enter questions at any moment you want by using the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen. Please do not, I repeat, do not, please use the chat function, use the Q&A function. This is the only place where I'm going to pick your questions up afterwards. So thank you very much. So for those of you who don't know us yet, No Silver Bullet is managed by Mark Lambert and myself with the aim of sharing Parkinson's expertise. We aim to help you and motivate you, frankly, to make informed choices on how to adapt your lifestyle, to manage your symptoms, and hopefully to slow down disease progression. That's what we all are looking for. We post the recordings of our webinars on YouTube and on Spotify, and we also post short videos on TikTok and Instagram. The details of those various websites and locations are available in the chat section at the bottom of your screen, as well as on our website. Our website is www.nosilverbullet4pd.com, nosilverbulletnumber4pd.com. But enough about me. Let's come back to today's topic and to Professor Christine Klein. Christine, thank you very much for agreeing to speak to us tonight. The stage is yours. I think you're muted.
I'm sorry. I should have learned this after all these years of Zoom meetings. So thank you very much, Michelle, and also Mark, for the kind introduction and for the invitation. Good afternoon, good evening, everyone. It's a great pleasure and honor to be here tonight. And as Michelle already said, we had the pleasure of meeting in person last year. And so this is when we spoke about the idea that I might be, you know, able to, you know, get in touch with all of you through one of these webinars. And this is what's happening tonight. And I'm very, very grateful and happy about this. So let me start sharing my screen and with the presentation. And then I'm looking forward, of course, already also to our Q&A session following the presentation. Okay, here we go. All right, so this is the title that I had been given, The Importance of Genetics and Finding a Cure for Parkinson's Disease. As one disclosure, I don't think I can give you the ultimate or the definitive answer tonight, but I think we're on a good way, and many things have been happening in the last few years, and I think a lot of things will happen in the next few years. So it is very important and exciting times that I think can be said without any exaggeration. Let me start by just outlining my disclosures and acknowledgements. And next, I would like to start with a quote. And this is a quote that was sent to me by email last summer in July 2023 by the husband of a patient with Parkinson's disease. I changed the names to protect confidentiality. And I think that the husband and maybe also his wife are even here tonight. So hello. And I hope that you don't mind me quoting this, because I think it's an incredibly insightful and important quote, very pertinent to tonight's topic. I think I mentioned that Julie has PD with a GBA mutation. However, I'm not sure I've seen good models that could explain the relatively low penetrance of PD. Julie has a brother who is 4 years older with the identical GBA variant, but no PD symptoms. What are your thoughts on why this GBA variant only sometimes converts to PD? And this is really the concept of penetrance. As you know, not everyone who carries a pathogenic variant or mutation will go on to develop Parkinson's. And some will do this earlier and others will do this very late in life. And understanding these factors and these modifiers, I think, is of utmost importance and a very, very important and very, very translationally important topic. So thank you for this quote and for this question. And I hope that we can shed a little bit of light on this during the course of my talk. So I really think we may be a little bit preoccupied with risk and cause, which is very important. Of course, we have to start there. But also there's compensation and protection. And so I think this is another field that's maybe a little bit understudied, but that can give us a lot of hope because, of course, especially when we think about, for example, Julie's brother who did not develop the disease, there are strong factors, both endogenous and exogenous ones, that protect us. We just don't understand them very well yet. And really, there are some first studies. I've just given you one example here. This is a genetic study 2 years ago that found a polygenic, so several genetic risk protective factors, not risk factors, coming together that promote resilience against the penetrance of Parkinson's disease. So people that carry a mutation that should be pathogenic are more resilient and they don't develop it or they develop it late. And so this is what I was thinking that we could cover. So let's use this magnifying glass and start by, this is actually the longest part, by reviewing some of the important concepts. Then I'll talk about translational impact, genetic modifiers that we already know, a little bit about human studies and models, and then the future directions. And this is just something I saw last week, and I thought it was very, very impressive. And this is actually the podium that Galileo Galilei used to teach. And this is at the University of Padua. So I think we stand on, on the shoulders of giants, which is wonderful. So hopefully, let's promote science together. So this is just what I was reminded of when I was there last week, and I wanted to share this with you. So let me just begin by introducing a patient of mine to you who came to visit, just on the occasion of a regular Wednesday morning clinic. And this is her. You can see that she has a bit of bradykinesia and resting tremor, especially in the right arm. This is in hand, and this is really what bothers her the most. And then I started taking the family history, which I always do. And this was somewhat surprising. As you can see here, a lot of her family members, in a dominant fashion, were also affected by a very similar phenotype. This is her, this is the family. And so you can see that even in a patient where there's nothing unusual about the Parkinson's, rather late onset, really, even in her early 60s, but there is a lot of other affected in the family. And so we have not yet found the gene that causes it here, but genetics can play an important role. And so, how important is this role, and how common are these hereditary forms? And there's actually two studies that have recently been conducted. They were both presented actually last year at the Parkinson's World Congress. Maybe some of you were there. And there is the PD Generation study that I'm sure many of you have heard about or maybe even participated in, mostly taking place in the US, but also Ecuador, I think, and Dominican Republic, where patients were offered genetic testing free of charge and a genetic testing report and counseling. And then this other study that I was involved with is the so-called ROPAD study. Both studies looked in relatively unselected patients. So these were not patients with a particularly early age of onset or with a family history like the one I just showed you, just any patient that walks into the clinic. Together, we looked at 35,000 patients. And so this is a very, very large, so the two of them together and even individually are the largest to date, hopefully soon published in Brain. This is where we submitted them together back to back. And this is what came out. So you can, of course, look at this pie chart from two different perspectives. You could say, oh, well, 85% of all Parkinson's patients don't have anything that can be found with the current methods in terms of genetics. But you could also say, 15% have something. And the biggest piece of this pie in blue is GBA1. So GBA1 that we heard about in the that I'm sure you're aware of, is the strongest genetic risk factor. And in fact, when you grow older, its penetrance, if you will, gets quite high, and it resembles then more of a monogenic, can resemble more of a monogenic cause than a risk factor. So this is the most common, 10%, roughly 10% of all patients have this. The gray piece of the pie is representing LRRK2, about 3%. And the little piece, the light blue one, this is everything else together. And parking, for example, accounts for about 1% of all findings. And now you want to know probably, okay, so how can I, is there anything different between those that have such a finding and those that don't? And yes, there is. If you look at this on the left, you have the patients with idiopathic Parkinson's disease. This means there was nothing found in the genetic study. And then on the right are the ones with a PD, Parkinson's disease, with a positive genetic testing report, so PD-PGT. And so when you compare the two, you can see very clearly that the ones with a positive finding have a lower age of onset. And this is statistically very highly significant. So we find this here 10 to the minus 34. At the same time, when you look at the difference in age of onset, the actual absolute difference, this is not very much. It's just a few years. So in practice, in clinical practice, we cannot tell in an individual patient whether, or mutation carrier, whether he or she and when and if they will become affected. So this is, I think, a very important take-home message. And also, there are several challenges that I would like to share with you, and maybe you're already aware of them. One challenge is that clinical observation is not always that helpful, especially not when it comes to distinguishing between different forms of genetic Parkinson's disease. And you can see here, all of these people have clinically typical Parkinsonism or Parkinson's disease, but they all carry a pathogenic variant or mutation that's the same, really. In one of the Parkinson's genes. So it's very hard based on a clinic visit to distinguish. So you really have to do the genetic test. And then again, what helps us distinguish between the different forms? And really, there are these seven that you may already know, or these are the seven most important ones that have been very well established. And you can see three of them highlighted here in red, DJ1, Parkin, and PINK1. They have the earliest age of onset. And they, on average, but again, its onset is in the 30s, not in childhood or not juvenile. And they are inherited in a recessive fashion. So in other words, both mother and father typically carry a mutation, and then two mutations have to come together in the offspring in a homozygous, as we call it, homozygous state, and then only then they develop the disease. The ones in blue, alpha-synuclein, SNCA, LRRK2 and VPS35, those three are inherited in a dominant fashion. In other words, a single mutation on one of the two copies of the gene. Just remember, you always get one copy from your father and one copy from your mother. So in this case, you have to have only one, either on the copy from your mother or on the copy from your father, and that will give you or can give you the disease. But it's also true that these not only do they have a much later age of onset, as you can see here, but also the penetrance is lower. So if you have one of these mutations in one of these genes, the risk of actually manifesting the disorder is lower than in the red ones, in the recessive ones, where penetrance is practically 100%. And then in gray, you have GBA1, which I just mentioned, which is some people call it the risk factor, others call it more also of a genetic cause. It really falls in between. The age of onset is the same as in LRRK2 mutation carriers. And so now there have been new biological classifications that came out. One came out a year and a half ago, another one just last month. And the first one, and this was really the front runner for this idea, actually also again uses penetrance, the very concept that the husband of the patient wrote to me about last summer. And so in Huntington's disease, you may know that this is a genetic, a neurological genetic disorder with involuntary movements. In fact, when you have too high a dose of, let's say, L-DOPA, what you then develop, the movements that you have, this is also a type of chorea. So this is the type of movement, but they have it due to a very different cause. It's always inherited. And they have too long a piece of this gene. And if you have more than 40 times a certain element of this gene, then this will become fully penetrant. So you will definitely get the disease if you live long enough. If you have a shorter repeat length, as you can see here, then penetrance will be reduced. And again, it's not clear whether and when you will develop the disease. And for Parkinson's, we have now adapted this concept. And you can see that fully penetrant, and I told you these are the recessive ones, for example, Parkin, and then reduced penetrance, we have LRRK2, and even more reduced GBA1. And why is this important? So Huntington's, in the Huntington's disease paper, they even defined the fully penetrant allele. So in other words, more than 40 of these repeats. If you have that, they call this stage zero Huntington's disease. And this is very important because they call this a disease. This is for research at this stage only, but they call it a disease, although you may not have developed any signs or symptoms yet. And that is important because it will change paradigms and it will change our approach to clinical trials with the hope, and I'll come back to that later within the context of diabetes, where we're already a little bit further ahead. And then it will pave the way towards studies in much earlier phases, maybe even preclinical phases, when the treatment might be most effective. And just to let you know, you may have seen or heard about this already. I will not talk about in detail about individual genes. There's no time to do that with so many things to cover. But I would like to highlight that a new gene has been found just now, which is called RAP32. And this is a very, very recent finding. It's not even out there yet in a journal, but it has been made publicly available on MedArchive, and you can see the MedArchives, and you can see the citation here on my slide. So this is a study led by Matt Farah, and he found that there's a new form of autosomal dominant Parkinson's disease, again, where one mutation is enough to cause the disease. And this, not only is this a new gene, but it has also been shown that it works together in a pathogenic pathway, if you will, together with LRRK2, the other gene that we have been known for quite some years. And let me just show you here, this is from the paper, some of the pedigrees. So it's very interesting to note that they come from different countries. So Tunisia, for example, Canada, here, UK, USA, Germany, and so on and so forth, Poland. And so lots of different ethnicities. And there's also reduced penetrance in some of these. Again, not surprising because it's a dominant gene. What is very interesting and perhaps a bit surprising, though, is, and you don't need to understand all G's and T's and all the genetic elements here of this scheme, all this shows is that this is in the area of this gene. All these patients that have this mutation, not only have they all the same mutation, but they also share the entire region in the genome. It's identical. So you can see that they all look the same in this region, all of these patients. And this is interesting. And what does it tell us? It tells us that all these people, although they come from so many different countries, are actually related. And they all got this from some founder individual who developed this many, many years, maybe hundreds of years ago. And this just shows you again how this new gene, this or protein rather here, the RAP32, how it interacts with LRRK2. So they work immediately together. Let's come to another challenge. And this is a challenge that we call phenocopy. And this is something you may have come across even before. And in fact, I did a systematic review of the pedigrees published in the literature. And I found that 5% of all these pedigrees have this phenomenon of a phenocopy. So what is a phenocopy? So you can see here, this is a pedigree again with a LRRK2 mutation. And you can see that the people that are affected carry the mutation, this one and this one. And there are actually a few other ones that we have now also seen. But then there is this one who's also affected, but he carries the wild type. So he is a phenocopy. So he looks like he copies the phenotype. He copies the clinical picture of the rest of his affected family members, but he seems to have a different cause. At least he doesn't have the cause that otherwise runs in the family. He looks the same. He looks like every other family member with Parkinson's disease, nothing special. And we don't yet understand why he got Parkinson's, but this phenomenon of the phenocopies is quite prevalent and poorly understood. What's also poorly understood is that we have very few data on non-white populations. And this is, I find, a disaster. So this study that we published a year ago is based on the entire world literature. And we wrote to, in the English language, I should say, so not the entire world literature, but the one published in the English language. And we then reached out to the authors of these studies and asked them to work with us and to give us more information on their patients and tell us whether they had others with known genetic forms. And half of them actually collaborated with us. And it was a great project. And this data is based on more than 4,000 patients with different genetic forms of Parkinson's. But you know what you can see here is that 3/4 of all of these patients are of white European origin. And then if you add this yellowish piece of the pie, this is white Ashkenazi Jewish people. And then if you add the white Berbers, you're really left with very, very few others in non-white populations. And I think this is an important gap that we need to fill, because it's very likely that there are different causes in different populations. And just recently, and I don't have the time to go into that in detail, just recently a new variant was found in the GBA1 gene that plays a hugely important role in Africans. But not in Europeans or Asians, for example. And so I'm thinking that this is another huge field that we need to really work on in the future, because we can learn. First of all, we need to understand, obviously, the entire genetic landscape and, you know, what is important for which population. And second, we can learn from each other. So this is a very, very important thing to follow up on. Another challenge, and please, you know, don't be put off by this very busy slide with all these different mutations. This is just to show you that there can be many, many different pathogenic variants or non-pathogenic variants in these genes or proteins. And this is the LRRK2 protein here, with all the different mutations known. And so sometimes it happens, and maybe this happened to you even, one gets a genetic testing report back, and it says, oh, you have a VUS or VUS or variant of uncertain significance. And most genetic testing companies don't even report these, but sometimes it happens. And it's quite frequent that it happens. And what does it mean? It's of uncertain significance, so we don't know what it means. And so this happened also to a family of ours that we were following here in Northern Germany. And they have this F1700L mutation, again, in the LRRK2 gene. The report came back and they said, well, this is a VUS, so we don't know what it means. And what did we do? Well, we looked in the other family members and it all made sense. And then we teamed up with colleagues in Dundee, Esther Samler and Dario Alessi, who developed wonderful assays to actually functionally test whether a mutation is really pathogenic, as we say, or whether it is benign, so it doesn't do anything bad. And as you can see here, this is you know, the kinase activity or a readout of kinase activity of our mutant, and you can see that this is highly elevated. So now we were quite sure that this really is a pathogenic variant or mutation that causes PD in this particular family. And this is important because there are now studies out, in particular also one for LRRK2, whereby we can now include this family as patients to take part in this trial. So this brings me to something very important. So what do we tell ourselves, the patients, the relatives? First of all, nothing is really written in stone. And I think this has to be understood very, very well, because genetics can change. Some people always think genetics is a black and white phenomenon, but it's not. It's possible, for example, and I showed you this, that in one population, some mutation or variant doesn't do anything, but in another population, it does. Or it's possible that we think something is a mutation, but then it turns out that is actually common, it's prevalent in 2% of the population. And then we would say, no, I think we made a mistake. I think it's not this mutation. So we have to be prepared. And this is something I always tell my patients, we'll do our very best with the methods available to date to find out what's going on, but we cannot say with certainty. We can be sometimes quite sure when there is, for example, a mutation that has been described many, many times before, then we can say, yes, we think that this is like 99%, you know, the cause of the disease. But it's also possible that we tell someone we didn't find anything, and then a new gene, I showed you RAP32, we didn't know about RAP32 a few months ago. And so this patient may have received a review, and in fact, this is exactly what happened. Within the ROPAD study, these were 13,500 patients. Quite a few have mutations in the RAB32 gene. We're now, of course, first validating this and looking whether everything's fine. But so we have to now then go back to them and say, okay, we didn't have a positive report for you before, but now we have a new gene and now things have changed. So, and this is why we have to be very honest to the patients and to ourselves that we try our best, but we may not always be able to tell you 100% answers. It's important to tailor these discussions to the actual patients. Some patients want to know everything. Others don't want to know anything. And yet others, like, for example, the one I showed you from one of my families here, of the Parkinson's families, he is actually a cattle breeder, and he wanted to know absolutely everything and knew so much about genetics and told me about the genome sequencing he does in his cows. And so we had a very, very interesting conversation. And so I'm always trying to meet, you know, expectations as best as I can. And then longitudinal is important. So we have to be in touch and remain in touch and see what's happening, because some things develop very slowly, fortunately. So there could be subtle signs that you see on one visit, but then it might take another 5 years until, you know, full-blown disease is visible. And then, of course, we need to be careful and not miss anything that could be actionable. So whenever we can take action, we should at least be aware of this and also tell the patient if they want to know. So, for example, if they want to know, is there a clinical trial that I could take part in, and there is a trial and it fits the mutation, I think we should tell them. Okay, so translational impact, just a little bit more about this ROPAD study. The results are based on 12,500 patients. Study was done by Anna Westenberger, or analyzed by Anna Westenberger here, and Peter Bauer. And so you can see here just the breakdown of the different mutations. And if you just focus on the right here on the percentages, again, GBA1 accounts for about 10%, LRRK2 for about 3%, followed by Parkin about 1%. And these are the most important and the most common mutations that were found. How about family history? Family history is also important. And you can see this again, the same comparison, those without a genetic finding and those with a genetic finding. Yes, family history, again, is more common. It's very statistically significant here. But again, the difference between 25% and 32 maybe percent, it's not that huge. And so on an individual basis, it doesn't help you. This is just looking at all the different mutations in the different genes and in this real world sample. And you can see that really the ages of onset, they all hover around mid-50s, 60s. And then only one stands out. And this is really the recessive ones, that you remember this from our literature review. So the same really came out and was confirmed in this real world scenario, that these patients have an earlier age of onset in their 30s. Of course, we really want to know, first of all, we want to know, you know, who has what pathology and who, you know, may be in a prodromal phase and maybe, you know, later develop something. So these are all very important questions. And there has been a very recent and very exciting development in the field of biomarkers. And this is called, this assay is called SAA, or alpha-synuclein seeding assay. And so SAA for short. And so we have performed this in a group of patients with Parkin mutations. And in Parkin, it's not clear. So basically, this assay looks at alpha-synuclein. And as you probably know, alpha-synuclein was the first gene to be found to be a cause of Parkinson's. Also, it's the main component of the Lewy bodies that are the pathological finding in the brains of Parkinson's patients. And so with Parkin mutations, it wasn't clear whether alpha-synuclein plays a role or not. And so in a blinded fashion, without the lab knowing who was, you know, a mutation carrier, who was a control, or who was affected, who was not, we performed this seeding assay. And those that seed are here highlighted in red, those that don't seed are in blue. And you can see out of 13 Parkin mutation carriers here, 8 did show this alpha-synuclein involvement, and 5 did not. So even among Parkin mutation carriers, there's this variability, and all of this will tell us something and will bring us closer to understanding who will potentially benefit, let's say, from an alpha-synuclein-related drug if it becomes available, right? So this is still early days. We're just trying to understand better in a very personalized fashion where people stand and what they have in terms of pathology that we can measure already in the living individual. The best, so this is done in blood, the by far the best opportunity though to do this is in CSF, in cerebrospinal fluid, but in the long run, hopefully we can also translate this really even in diagnostics to blood, which is obviously so much easier to obtain. So let's come to genetic modifiers. And so there are and other modifiers as well. So again, coming back to the monogenic cause. So let's say somebody has a LRRK2 G2019S mutation. And this is common. And as you saw, maybe from the ROPAD results, 82% of our LRRK2 mutations that we found were exactly this mutation. So this is by far the most common that has been described in LRRK2. And however, as I said, penetrance is reduced and not everyone gets it. Not everyone gets it, even if they get it at the same age and the same severity. So this is what the authors did. They looked into this penetrance question and found that there is a polygenic risk score or polygenic, the other side of the coin would be polygenic protection score that modifies this penetrance. So the risk of developing, of manifesting the disease. So that is one type of modifier. So there could be a group of other genes that modify the expression of the LRRK2 mutation. And if you think about this, this is very plausible. Why should it be a single variant in our genome or a single mutation that explains everything? It won't, right? You have so many, you have millions and billions of other genes and modifiers and other genetic genotypes, if you will. And of course, it's very plausible that they will play a role one way or another. Also, there are other things that can be considered. You may have heard about mitochondria. So mitochondria are the little powerhouses of the cell, and they are very potent, and they produce all our energy, and they produce a lot of energy. In fact, they produce about 80 kilos a day. Luckily, we don't grow by 80 kilos every day, but we use it up. But it's just a remarkable achievement that the little mitochondria do for us. They are very important also in Parkinson's disease. Some genes affect directly the function of these little mitochondria. And you can see if you compare those patients that have a LRRK2 mutation and no PD, their activity, their mitochondrial activity is actually better than that of those people that have PD. The same mutation, here no PD, here yes PD. And then there's also the environment. And there's very few studies in monogenic Parkinson's and the environment, but this is a nice one that was actually done by a PhD student in our lab, PhD student of Joanne Trins. And so she looked in a Tunisian population, together with colleagues from Tunisia, obviously, in LRRK2 mutation carriers. And again, the question was, what influences the age at onset? And it turns out that those people are the most protected, so they have the latest age of onset in their mid-60s, that drink black tea and that smoke. Tea is for tobacco. Which, of course, I don't suggest starting to smoke. Obviously, that's not healthy, but black tea might be a good idea. Those that only have black tea also already have a lower age of onset, similar to the tobacco smokers. And those that neither smoke nor drink black tea, they have the lowest age of onset. Again, this is a difference by quite a few years. So this is interesting. And we're just starting to understand this interplay of genes, mitochondrial function, and also environmental exposures. And again, we have done this also, have looked in more detail at the mitochondria. And the mitochondria are little organelles. They look like bacteria, really, and they used to be bacteria, but we just live with them together in synergy. And they, as I mentioned, they can also be become unhealthy. And if they are not healthy anymore, they are typically removed and mitochondria just divide, and then you have two new mitochondria. But if this process doesn't work so well, then mutations accumulate in the mitochondria, and that's not good. And that's happening sometimes in Parkinson's disease. And you can see that here, this is idiopathic Parkinson's patients, they have the lowest number of mitochondrial mutations. This is patients with a specific Parkin mutation or PINK1 mutation, where we know that they affect the function of these little powerhouses. And this is people with a recessive form. They have two mutations, so they have the largest number of mutations in the mitochondria. So just to show you that there are other factors, not just our genes, but also the mitochondrial genome, that is important. And there is one disease, I'm sorry, that is a form of Parkinsonism, X-linked dystonia Parkinsonism, it's called, where all the patients, again, are related, similar to what I told you for the RAP32. They all share the same mutation. And in this case, they all come from the Philippines, from one island. And they also share typically the same environment. And here, because it's so homogeneous, we were able to identify genetic markers. And we even made a little calculator here on the right, where you can type in the different markers, and then you click here, and then you have a point estimate of the age of onset in any given person. So we can predict with quite high accuracy if and when they will become affected. But of course, we have this information for this rare disease, which is so homogeneous. We are only starting to learn this for other forms of Parkinson's disease. Human studies are very important. And of course, Parkinson's disease is a human disease. And no dog or no cat or not even a monkey will get Parkinson's disease, right? This is a very human disease. Unlike infections, for example, they happen everywhere. And so what did we do? We actually took a different approach. So this is an area in northern Italy, beautiful area, mountainous area. And people live there sometimes in very isolated villages in the mountains. And sometimes they also intermarry. And so there is a high frequency of certain mutations, for example, Parkin mutations. And what did we do? We selected 50 people with a mutation and 50 without. They were all healthy still. Nobody had any signs, any clinical signs. And the clinical team here had no idea who carried a mutation and who did not. So we were blinded. And then we performed a gait analysis. You can see this here with sensors. So a very detailed gait analysis, because I told you clinically, just by visual inspection, we didn't see anything. But with this, with these sensors, we were able to record the gait in a much better fashion. And then using an algorithm, an AI-based algorithm, we were able, totally blinded, to predict the genotype, whether or not the mutation was present, with 86% accuracy. Okay, coming briefly to models. Why are we using models? So you may have heard, of course, there are mouse models, there are many other models, there are fly models in Parkinson's disease. And maybe you heard that the fly has really helped us a lot. There were two wonderful papers in Nature almost 20 years ago that really explained a lot about the pathogenesis of Parkinson's disease. And so in our lab, we also work with flies, and they're actually quite easy to work with because they have a short life cycle and they're easy to, easy to keep. And so this is what we're doing. And so this is a paper by Melissa Foss, who is actually running the fly lab here at the Institute. And she found a little over 10 years ago that vitamin K2 is a mitochondrial, again, we're again talking about the little powerhouses of the cell, electron carrier that rescues PINK1 deficiency. PINK1 is another gene, one of the three recessive genes, Parkin, PINK1, work in the same pathway together. So she found, okay, vitamin K2 can help us because it improves the mitochondrial function. And so I will now show you what this looks like in flies. So this is a fly with an uncoordinated flight. And you may remember, you probably have in the summer, we all have these flies, right? They like to sit in our fruit baskets. And this fly doesn't fly normally. The next fly here is bradykinetic. This fly doesn't really fly much at all. It's very slow. Of course, this is only as good as it gets to mimic Parkinson's disease in a fly. What does a normal fly look like? Well, you know this, just to remind you, they happily crawl about and fly and jump. And so this is what a normal fly looks like. And I think you can see here that these flies are not normal. And if you feed them vitamin K2, they become normal. And so this is obviously a very exciting finding, and we have turned this into a little trial, into a little clinical trial. And this is one of the answers: why can genetics be important? Because if you pick the right form, a specific form of a genetic form of Parkinson's, then maybe we can have very tailored, personalized therapies. And so what we did, we used vitamin K2 in very high doses, higher than what you can get, you know, in a pharmacy or drugstore, and actually gave this to patients. There were even some from the UK who flew over for the study, and placebo controlled. We have the data. We have not yet unblinded the study, but this is happening later this year. And we used here, because it was only for a short time, so we are not expecting the patients to actually become better clinically, but we're using an imaging, an MRI imaging parameter to measure the function of the mitochondria, how well they do. And so this will be very interesting to see whether we can actually see a difference in those treated and those untreated. In fact, we had a little open label pilot at the beginning, and there we saw quite a big difference. So I'm very curious to see what comes out of this study. Okay, so I'm coming to the future directions, and also, of course, to a summary. So we saw genes, we saw genetic modifiers, we saw human studies. I showed you a model, Drosophila, and now we're coming to, you know, where do we go next? And sometimes it's good to put on a pair of special glasses. And so this is a picture I took on the occasion of another conference visit to the to Brno, which is a beautiful city in the Czech Republic. And this is where they have the Mendel Museum. As you may know, this is where Gregor Mendel undertook all his experiments, his genetic experiments. And this is his actual glasses. So first of all, where do we want to go? We would like to predict treatment outcomes. Is this possible already? Well, careful. I have to be very careful. Yes, you may have heard there are some genetic forms of PD, those with GBA1 mutations, for example, where sometimes the outcome is not quite as good as in those that don't have this mutation, or there may be more cognitive changes. This is all still very early days, and we're only starting to understand differential responses to different treatments. It's more clear in some forms of dystonia Parkinsonism. And I would just like to show you one example where really we now can counsel the patients because we have enough experience. We have operated, for example, on 25 such patients here in Lübeck, and many more patients have been operated in the meantime elsewhere, and especially in the Philippines. This is, again, this disease in the Philippines, this Parkinson form of Parkinsonism in the Philippines, which responds exquisitely to levodopa, to deep brain stimulation. And so this is something we then can tell the patient that in this, if you carry this particular mutation, of course, it's not nice to have the mutation, but if you have it, then at least your response to the treatment will be very favorable. And I will show you how favorable it is. This is the patient before the operation. He cannot walk independently. And this is him 5 days after the operation, practically a normal gait. 1 year later, he gained a lot of weight in the meantime in the back in the Philippines. So this is obviously a beautiful outcome, and all 25 responded and very, very favorably, and many of them to the same extent as this patient. So this is very important information that we now actually convey to the patient. We do not promise 100% it will be beautiful, but we say the chances of this working are high. And then, of course, why is it important to know the genotype? Because there will hopefully be more and more gene-targeted treatments. There are already GBA1 studies, and of course, I don't have time to discuss all of them now, and I probably even don't know all of them, but one trial that has recently started and that is targeted towards LRRK2 is a trial that uses LRRK2 inhibition. So LRRK2, what happens is when you have this mutation, it works too well, it does too much. And so basically it needs to be inhibited, it needs to be brought down. And this is the idea of this particular drug. Initially, there was a specific arm of this study for LRRK2 mutation patients. Later, the company decided, no, we put them all together. And now they had second thoughts and they said, no, this is very recent. I only heard about this a week ago. Now they started to go back and hopefully allow a better, more focused trial, not just any PD patient, but for those that carry LRRK2 mutation, because the hope and the thought is that these patients will benefit the most. And I will show you now just one of the very young members of one of the families with LRRK2 mutations that we have been following here in Lübeck. And he is only in his late 20s, and he's totally asymptomatic. So he doesn't think that anything is wrong. However, when I ask him to do the finger tapping, please watch closely. I don't think this is normal. Look at this. It's a bit arrhythmic. It's not quite. The left hand is better. Just let's do this again. So a 25-year-old should be able to do, oops, where do we see this? Should be able to do it like this, right? So he cannot. He also has a bit of rigidity in his right arm. He does not have Parkinson's disease. And we didn't tell him he has Parkinson's disease. We only told him that we found some differences, side differences, you know, when it comes to these finger movements. However, he would be a very good candidate to be enrolled if he wants to do so in such a trial. And hopefully in the future, when we know that these drugs hopefully will work, then we can start much earlier. And this is again when genetics helps us, because we can then find and identify individuals that have the earliest of stages, where where very few neurons hopefully are, you know, have been affected, and they have the best chance of responding to these types of treatments. Then there are many new therapeutic options. And again, I can not mention them all, but there is a lot. So there are new drugs, of course, all the time. So for example, there's the levodopa that you can inhale now. There's even the first gene scissors, CRISPR-Cas treatment, not for Parkinson's, but for a blood disorder. So this has been approved at the end of last year. So genetic methods are being used to treat specific genetic forms of diseases. There are antibody treatments, as you can see here. There are small molecules that are being tried, like the LRRK2 inhibitor. And there's, of course, lifestyle factors. And these are really, really important as well. Again, we don't understand them all, and it's very difficult to study them. As you can imagine, we can, of course, ask you how many cups of tea did you drink or something, but it's not like with a genome. In the genome, we just look at every single base pair that you have. But here we cannot. We don't even know sometimes what is relevant and what's not. And you may not remember what you did 45 years ago. And this may have been the important time when whatever environmental exposure or insult may have hit, right? So this is very difficult. And still, we're making progress. And this is a study that was just published here in Germany. It's on dementia, but I found this a very, very beautiful study and with a very somewhat optimistic outcome. So in Germany, we have close to 2 million people with dementia. We have a population of about 85 million people. And there it is a thought, and there's good evidence that there are 11 known risk factors for dementia. And some of them are actionable. And if you bring down the risk of these different factors, some exposures, bad nutrition, lack of physical activity, things like this, if you improve those or bring down the risk factors by only 15%, we would have 140,000 fewer patients with dementia. That's the prediction. So these things are powerful. We still need to study them more. We need to understand them better. The best study in this realm is being conducted by Bas Bloom. Maybe he was already a speaker here as well. And he is conducting exactly this type of study in a LRRK2 patient population, trying to see what exercise does for you. And so now I promised to you I would come to diabetes. Maybe you're thinking, well, why is she talking about diabetes now? Because I think this is such a holds such promise. And so this is a paper that I came across for the first time in 2019 when it was published. And what it did, something very exciting. It gave an antibody, so a really effective treatment, to relatives, to healthy people, relatives of patients with diabetes, but they did not have the disease yet. So they were only at risk for the type 1 diabetes. And why were they at risk? Because they had a relative, so a genetic risk to develop type 1 diabetes. And so they gave the antibody to these people. And again, of course, this was placebo controlled. And those who got the actual drug, those who got the actual antibody, developed diabetes on average 4 years later than those that had gotten the placebo and not the drug. So this really is the first example. Just happened last fall that the FDA approved the first drug that can delay the onset of type 1 diabetes. At the moment, we have no such drug for Parkinson's, but my sincere hope, and with everything I've showed you and all the people working on this together, I think this is something that hopefully will come. And then hopefully we can also identify people at risk, genetic risk or other risk, and can then act early and delay and postpone and maybe even at some point cure. But I don't want to get the hopes too high. I think there's still a long way to go, but I think it's not impossible. And so finally, I thought as an as a different perspective, perhaps, I would like to share with you the clinician scientist's point of view. We are trying, of course, to understand the patient's point of view. And I'm very aware of the fact that we spend far too little time together and that we need to learn and be inspired, by you much more. But maybe it's interesting for you also to see what do the clinician scientists think. And these are the people that actually combine the clinical work and the science, and that try to, really move the science further and really come to new therapeutic options. And so I have interviewed 12 of them, and you can see them here. So I've interviewed six that are at our center here, and then six international ones from Argentina, from the US, from Kyrgyzstan, from Malaysia, from the Philippines, and from Australia. And this was a wonderful exercise, and I wanted to know from them what they think and why are they driven and what and how can we motivate them, right? Or how are they motivated to do this important work? And so this is just them, just to show you again, they come from these different areas. And Marielle helped me here to put all of this together. Half males, half females. Most of them do, or more than half do clinical research, but there are also some that are in basic science. And it's important to put these two together to understand all these, the whole spectrum from the molecule to the cure in the end. I just wanted to read to you what one of these clinician scientists said, and this is Dr. Aihui Tan from Malaysia, and I thought she had incredibly insightful answers, which I would like to share with you here. So the first question, and I asked all 12 of them the same four questions. So I asked them, why is it important for you to combine clinical and research work? So Aihui said, as I grow as a researcher, I become a better clinician with clearer thought processes. As I grow as a clinician, I become a better researcher with clearer research questions and ideas. Combining clinical and research work is like creating a natural self-improvement feedback loop that ultimately enables me to better serve my patients while making an impact in a larger community. The second question, what was your most gratifying experience or best opportunity so far? And she answers, seeing the joy of service in our research patients and their families. Many are very thankful for the opportunities to contribute to scientific discoveries on a disease that has grappled their lives. In one of our research patient appreciation events at our hospital, a young onset Parkinson's disease patient told her daughter, "This is the best day of my life after Parkinson." What was your biggest challenge? Sometimes everything is happening everywhere all at once. It's not just about time management, but rather timing management. And that is learning the right time to take a job or roll out a new idea. And then what is the most important advice you would give to others or to your supervisors? And also to patients, I think it is, seek out your unique strength. And remember to leverage on your strength in building your research trajectory and really building, on the fight against Parkinson's disease. So I thought hopefully this is interesting for you to see, what the people do to try and help and improve and understand and treat Parkinson's better. And with this, I'm coming very close to the end. I just wanted to share with you again another sight of hope. And this is the Global Parkinson's Genetics Program, coordinated by Andy Singleton and Cornelis Bavandrad at NIH in the US. An absolutely amazing program. Here in Lübeck, we are coordinating the monogenic part, so the part where we have a genetic form of Parkinson's, and we have already received over 5,000 samples just here in Lübeck from all over the world, really from Mongolia to Chile, from everywhere. So this is very exciting. We're really hoping to make good progress towards a better understanding of the genetics of Parkinson's. And this is our team here of the monogenic part. And with this, I'm at the end of my presentation and would like to thank you. And of course, also thank, because I showed you lots of data and studies. So this is the team here in Lübeck, and they say hello to you. And thank you so much for listening and looking forward to now our discussion.
Thank you very much, Christine, for a fascinating presentation on the topic, which for you, of course, is your daily bread and butter. But for us, maybe slightly more complicated, and you made it approachable and understandable by everyone. I think that I'm particularly interested in the fact that actually, all the people you showed us, including yourself, help us understand how to personalize medicine better to match our individual profiles. And also, I was quite struck by the fact that actually you could help people detect early if they are at risk of developing Parkinson's, and potentially, which is the really interesting thing, to be able to delay the onset. So thank you very much for that.
Yeah. But like I said, it's all, you know, there's lots of theoretical things and some are possible, but we're not quite there yet. So I cannot offer you now the test, which will tell you exactly, right? That's not where we are, but we're moving definitely in that direction. Yeah.
We're very disappointed. We were expecting a big breakthrough tonight. <I'm joking.
laughs> Well, we keep going.
Thank you so much.
We keep going together. You know, that's the thing. So all the research I've been doing has always been very closely related to patients and families and people. And we could not have done any of the work, really any of the work without you. And it's really a common journey. Yeah.
Thank you. Before I forget, you mentioned Bas Bloom. And exercise, and we have on our YouTube channel two presentations by Bas Bloom, one on exercise indeed, and one more recently on nutrition. So he's covered both topics.
Yeah, he's wonderful. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And I also wanted to say that Rich and Paula are thrilled that you used their question in this presentation. So the family, I think you were referring to.
Excellent.
I will not mention
the
surname, but actually they say thank you.
Excellent. Nice to hear from you again. I didn't want to disclose the name without asking, but this is wonderful. Yeah.
No, Mirko, first question here. Mirko is basically saying, slightly in a challenging way, I think in a nicely challenging way, isn't genetics in relation to PD just a matter of statistics and therefore not very relevant as long as nobody knows what causes PD?
Yes, I like that question. It's very provocative, but I think it's not true that nobody knows what causes PD. I think in the majority, in at least these 85%, we don't. That's true, and you can say that that's nothing. But I think, you know, in 15%, we have an answer. And even though we don't always fully understand how then the mutation leads to the disease, but there's a lot of understanding also about these pathways now. And so I think in a fraction, admittedly a small fraction, but there we do know what causes it, I would say.
Thank you very much. Dietrich is basically saying that he's surprised that RAB32 was detected only now, since its dominant position and its large effect. How
yes.
is that possible?
yeah, you're right. How is it possible? So it's rare, first of all, and of course it's almost always, these mutations are rare, and it's always more difficult to find rare things. Also, as you saw, all of these people basically are one family, right? So the question is, the jury is still out whether there are other mutations also in this gene. So far, we know only about this single one. And it has reduced penetrance. Of course, it's always more difficult to find such dominant genes because they don't always manifest. And in the combination of something dominant, reduced penetrance, and rare, but honestly speaking, it was found already 5 years or 5 or 7 years ago. But then it took the researchers so long to really prove it and to find more families and to be sure. And so this is just to show you also how long it can take sometimes to really validate a finding, right?
It's a whole process of research and research after research until
you
build something which is presentable.
That's right, exactly right.
So Andy is asking, he's referring to the study where one of the patients had L1700 gene. And he's asking if there is anything that can be done to remove or counter the bad gene.
Well, yes, I mean, the first idea that we had was now to enroll this family in this trial. So this mutation also results in too much activity of the LRRK2 protein. So they have the exact same problem as patients with the G2019S or with other. So they can also be enrolled now into this study where an inhibitor tries to bring down this activity. Of course, this raises another very important point. There could be a potential of specific gene therapy sometime in the future. At this stage, not available yet. I'm also not aware of a trial that does that, but it's definitely something that I would say that will come.
Jackie is asking an interesting question here, and I'm thinking of what you said about mitochondria in particular. She's asking if it's possible to change gene expression through behavioral or lifestyle changes, for instance, stress reduction or nutrition. You mentioned the black tea, for instance.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think I think it's absolutely plausible. I think it's absolutely possible. The only thing is, I don't know of any study that has really convincingly shown this, right? This would be a big endeavor to do such a study. I think very important. And I would be absolutely surprised if we didn't find anything. It just hasn't been done yet. And as you can imagine, it would have to be done under very controlled circumstances, right? I mean, you cannot just, because, some people may eat too much ice cream or others start smoking, or yet others take some hormones, and all of these things may have an influence. So to control this, like we can do this in our flies or even in mice, in humans is always extremely difficult. And especially when it comes to gene expression, it's so dependent on so many things. Just if you have a common cold, your gene expression will look very different. And even the cell composition that you use looks different. If you have a cold, you have more white blood cells, right? So then, and you get your gene expression typically from blood. So there are so many things that can confound, as we say, such studies. That it's just to show you how difficult it can be. Not impossible, but it's definitely not something that we can show very easily. Yeah.
Thank you. Isaac has a question, which is not so much for you as a geneticist, but maybe that we're having watched people with Parkinson's for so long, you would have a view. He's basically saying that if a patient can't find a positive gene, the 15%, if you're not among those 15%, which is my case, for instance, I got a negative report on my genetic
Yeah.
landscape. Is there any way to find out what has been causing your PD, like external factors such as exposure to chemicals or being violent sports or something like that?
Yeah, this is a very, very important question, and it's and I, unfortunately, I don't have a very good answer to this. First, well, how can I break this down? So first of all, I'm thinking there could be more genetic factors. Some we saw just are up 32 has just been found. I think there's probably a few more, but it won't explain everything. I think in the majority, and this again is not a very good answer perhaps, but in the majority of people, it will be some genetic makeup that comes together with certain exposures. And also, as I said, what I think is also very important, how well we are equipped to counteract these things. Some people, and we know this also from other things. So for example, some people, they can walk out in the cold and in the snow, even barefoot, and nothing happens. Another person does that and immediately gets cold, right? So we are very differently equipped with our, immune system, with all these things. And so this is something that makes us, it's nice that we're so variable, but it makes it very difficult to predict. Also, when it comes to the environmental exposures, there are very few things that are really, really cut in stone. If you have a carbon monoxide poisoning, or if you have, an MPTP, if you're a drug addict in the 80s in California, then this will give you, but this won't give you idiopathic Parkinson's disease. This will give you a different disease. So this helped us to understand mechanisms, especially mitochondrial function, but it's not our Parkinson's disease. When it comes to head trauma, it seems to be a very important factor and a very strong risk factor. At the same time, you may have heard that Muhammad Ali, it was always thought that it had been the multiple head traumas that gave him Parkinson's. It turns out that he actually had quite early onset, and his brother has the same, and he was not a boxer. So my theory is that they actually have Parkin mutation. I can't prove this, but I wouldn't be surprised if they had a genetic predisposition at least. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I have a question from Lucille Leader. Actually, I want to say hi to Lucille, and Mark and I came to meet each other through Lucille, who is quite a well-known PD nutritionist. So Lucille is basically saying, great presentation, thank you. And she wanted you to repeat, if you don't mind, the mutation in the Philippines group and the name of the neurological surgical department.
Yes, of course. So this disease that is so endemic, as we say, to the Philippines is called X-linked dystonia Parkinsonism. And it's X-linked because it's on the X chromosome, in this case, the mutation. So it affects mostly men. And they have initially more dystonia, so dystonic movements, especially of the face. And then in later phases, they can look exactly like a Parkinson's patient. Mm. They all share the same mutation. It's on, as I said, on the X chromosome, and it's in the so-called TAF1 gene, which is related to gene expression, interestingly. Yes. They have all the same mutation, and they respond, as I showed you very well, to deep brain stimulation, and all these 25 deep brain stimulation procedures were done here in-house in Lübeck.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Christine. Just to our audience, I wanted to tell you, everyone, that actually I'm keeping those questions that are more specific to one individual for the end. So I'm tackling first those questions that will interest most people, and I will then go into those that are specific to a smaller population. So someone anonymously asking, are specific symptoms linked to particular mutations? So that's interesting.
Yeah, that is very interesting. And I can say yes and no. So I think when it comes to, for example, alpha-synuclein, which I didn't have time to discuss much, there we have a clear relationship between even the numbers. So the alpha-synuclein gene, as I told you, we typically have one gene from each parent, so two copies. Alpha-synuclein can be duplicated, so one of them, so then we have three copies. One is duplicated, one just single. Mm-hmm. It can even be triplicated, so then we have three on the one and just one on the other. So we have four altogether, so double the amount that we should have. And the more copies you have, there are even people with five that have been described, the more copies you have, the earlier the age of onset and the more severe the disease. Interestingly, this is not always true. In LRRK2, for example, there are also people that carry, because in some populations, this LRRK2 variant is very, very common as well, and they carry both, two on both copies mm-hmm. of the gene, and they look no different from those that have only one copy of the gene. So again, it's always unpredictable. The recessive ones, yes, they are different in that they have a much earlier age of onset, typically at least 15 years earlier, and a slower progression. For example, this has been shown in larger groups, but for example, I can tell you about one patient of mine who had an age of onset of 13, and in his 70s, he was still able to ride a bike. And so this shows you that over so many decades of Parkinson's, that this has a slow progression. So yes, there are differences, but in an individual patient, difficult to predict. You can have the full spectrum across, even in one family. So therefore, I'm always mm-hmm. a bit, yeah.
So I have actually a question from two people, one anonymously and one from Jackie, that is basically around the same topic. If I get my gene test done, what do I do with it? And basically the other question, which is linked to the same topic, is that should we go for genetic testing? That person has put it off because of their sons, in case it would cause problems with insurance, etc.
Yeah.
So there is the topic of what do you do with it, and actually should you do it, or are there downsides to doing it?
Right. Oh, yes, of course. I mean, so let's start with a very personal decision. A gene test, I think, is first and foremost, a personal decision. And it will give you information on yourself, about yourself, but it may also have an impact on your family. And this is something that we have to consider very carefully. And then there are different types of people. Most people that, you know, in my experience, would like to know whether they have, but there are others that just don't want to know. There are yet others, they say, I don't want to know, but I want to participate in research. I think your work is important, mm-hmm. but don't tell me. So there's a whole spectrum. And I think it's very important to, I think there's definitely not one size fits all. And it's absolutely at the discretion of the people. So, and then should you do it or not? I would say if we had this drug, or one or two or three drugs that, you know, really delayed the onset or could stop the progression or something in specific forms, then I would say, yes, I would really recommend having the test. Then we can tailor the treatment, you know, then we can give you the right drug. But we're not there yet. And so therefore, I have to be very careful with this recommendation. If I were at risk, I would probably try to get enrolled in a trial. And to be enrolled in a trial typically goes, obviously, entails genetic testing. Those things, however, should not impact insurance, because this is outside the medical, official medical system and treatment. And so then this should not. But nobody can, 100% ensure that anything happens. In many countries, as you know, there are these non-discrimination acts like GINA in the US and in many European countries. It should not happen, but it's definitely something one should think about carefully. And every genetic test requires proper counseling. You need to have a person that you trust and that understands the implications, that you can talk to. And typically, we never have the patient decide on the same day. And really think about it, go back to your family, your friends, and then make this decision. And as I said, it can be a difficult decision. It can be the most difficult outcome, really, is typically when we don't know. When I tell you, oh, well, we found something, it could be, it could not be, that is something that's hard. It's hard for the patient, but it's also hard for us, because we would like to tell you, but we can't, and so I try to prepare before the test is done. I try to prepare for this scenario.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Rich and Paul. I have an important question, actually. I could almost have kept it as the last one, but actually, there are quite a few more before that. What can we in the general PD community do to help the effort? For example, they're mentioning participating in the PD generation research project. Maybe you can explain what it is. I think they do a full genomic analysis.
Yes, I think exactly. I think participate, please, in as many, well, good, high quality studies as possible, right? Then really, when we get these large numbers, I think we then really have very firm, then we can give good answers. Just, yeah, I forgot to actually, this is the question before. So what we have put together, and some of you, I didn't have time to show this today, it's called MDS Gene. It's an online program. It's basically also a tool where we put together all the data on all the published in the English language, what I showed you before a little bit, all this information. And you can play with this. So you can, for example, say, I want to know everything about LRRK2. I want only the females. I want only this. So you can use this information, but you will see there are red bars that tell you when the symptom is there, or a sign. For example, bradykinesia. Pretty much everyone has it, right? But then, and blue bars is when if you don't have it. For example, you have no dystonia, you have no cognitive decline. So then you would have a blue bar. But then you will see very, very many gray bars. And the gray bars mean this, the studies or the papers have not mentioned this. And this is a problem. And when it comes to, for example, the non-motor signs, let's say sleep disturbances or depression or something like this, the gray bars are huge. So in other words, we have information really only on a very small minority. And this is a problem. And I'll tell you why. Just imagine, let's say we don't know, a paper has not mentioned bradykinesia. Then what would you think? You would say, well, they didn't mention it, but it will be there, right? It's Parkinson's. This is part of the definition. So it will be there. However, if it comes to another symptom, like a psychosis, you would say, well, if they didn't mention it in the paper, I don't think it would be there, because it's such a striking thing, they would have mentioned it, right? So you have a very different perspective. And this is a huge problem with the missing data. So please, yes, please do participate in trials, in good trials. And this way we will together be able to answer these questions, because now we have a lot of missing data and gaps.
Exactly. So John is asking if there is a way to determine which mutations are hereditary versus environmentally acquired.
Very good point. A fantastic question. So again, we need to know much more about this.
I'm proud of our audience.
In fact, this is exactly true. So as you know, our neurons, basically, they don't do much, right? They don't divide, they don't renew each other. It's not like if you have a problem with your skin, then it will heal, right? This is unfortunately not the case with neurons. And so what happens, of course, is over the course of your lifetime, we all accumulate these types of mutations, and we call this in a somatic fashion. So this happens in your body, and it's not something you inherited from your parents, but it's something that happens during your lifetime. And I showed you this for mitochondria. When they get old, they get more mutations. And the same probably happens, or we have some evidence that this happens. And so this is again another field, and this requires to really fully understand this, requires more brain donation, because we obviously can't tell this in a living individual, right? But we have far too few brains. So just to give you examples of the genetic forms, PINK1, for example, to my knowledge, there's exactly two brains available. how much information is that? But you know, almost nothing. So I know that this is a very difficult thing to talk about and to think about. And if I think about it, also I'm thinking, but if some answers can only be given, I think through the brains, and therefore this good brain donation programs, I think, is also something that needs to be supported.
I would just say that actually we need those brain donations program to reach out to us as a community, because I wouldn't know who to contact to give my brain.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a bit of a both ways, but actually I think that if the message from the scientific community was reaching the PD population of this is how you can support us by taking part to trials, and this is how you can support us the day you pass away, because we that's one thing for sure, we all one day from Parkinson's
one day
or
we all
not,
pass
pass
away.
away.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So the Dopamine Warriors Boxing Club, hello guys and ladies, is asking if there is any efficacy if you have the GBA gene and go on and have a DBS operation.
Yes, it does work also in GBA mutation carriers, absolutely. However, there have been studies, again, every study can be fraught with some problems, but there have been studies that maybe the effect is not quite as wonderful as in someone without such a mutation, and that maybe the side effects after the operation, that there could be a bit more rapid decline in cognitive function. But this is, it's not that, you know, not to the extent that we would say, you know, don't go on and don't have it. But just to explain that maybe the outcome will be a little bit less favorable than in someone who doesn't have it. So that's the situation.
Thank you very much. So Christine, let's go into, we still have like 20 open questions. We may not be able to do all of them, but let's just try to, we have answered already 15, so we're doing good.
Okay.
but let's go through some of the more specific questions that are affecting people individually. Sorry, Jill is basically saying that she has the GBA E326K mutation. She was diagnosed at age 39 and has had a slow progression. What can you tell us about that specific mutation that she has?
Well, I can say it's very common. The thing is also with these, you know, with every mutation, and so this is a relatively early age of onset. However, the progression is slow. And sometimes, so overall, people think in GBA is more later age of onset and then faster progression. But this is a very good example. And I have such a patient too. She has such a slow progression that I thought she must have Parkin. And then she had GBA1, so I was surprised. So it's hard to tell, you know, in an individual patient, what, you know, how the mutation will evolve. However, in GBA, and this is why this is a great question as well, an important question. In GBA1, we basically distinguish three different types. So we distinguish the severe, so-called severe mutations that have, you know, much higher risk really to develop the disease, and the milder ones, and then the ones that we call just risk factors. So this is what we're distinguishing, but again, only starting to understand, you know, which mutation is more likely to do what.
So here another specific question from Robert. He basically says he has the PINK1 mutation, and he's asking what treatments are on the horizon and if there are any promising trials out there at the moment.
Yes, to my knowledge, in PINK, it's very rare, obviously, mutations of PINK1 gene, so it's a little understudied. There's a lot of interest by the Michael J. Fox Foundation, though, I should say. They're collecting patients with PINK1 mutations and their biomaterials, so blood and RNA and other things, to study this better. So this would be one type of study one can participate in, but it's obviously not a clinical trial. We have done two trials in PINK1 patients. One is the one with vitamin K2, but that has been completed, and one used coenzyme Q10, again, with the idea to enhance mitochondrial function. I'm not aware of any current trial in PINK1, but I'm sure that this will also happen, and also in conjunction with Parkin, because these genes work so closely together.
Thank you very much. I have a couple of questions about the vitamins K2s that you mentioned, one from Leni and one from Ken. Ken is asking how promising it is. Is it, sorry? And Leni is asking which form of vitamin K2 is helpful. She's mentioning 4 or 7. I'm not a specialist in K2, but she must be referring to different types.
This is a very important and obviously very highly educated question. Honestly speaking, I don't recall now. I do remember that we underwent, you know, we talked a lot to biochemists and lots of people and companies. Which type in this paper that I showed on the vitamin K2, you can find exactly which type we've eventually used. This is also true for the coenzyme Q10. There's also very many different ones, and you need to use the most effective one. Unfortunately, off the top of my head, we designed the study 4 or 5 years ago. I don't recall this, but it's absolutely a very valid question. And we couldn't decide this on our own, but we really had to team up with biochemists and yes.
Thank you. So sometimes as a facilitator of those sessions, I have questions that I do not fully understand. And this is one of them. I do apologize. Are there any CRISPR programs known to be in development for PD gene mutations?
Right. Yeah, no, this is a great question. So in fact, this is what I had with my little gene scissors. So again, not to my knowledge, in the research realm, absolutely yes.
Can you explain what it is? I'm so sorry. I may be the only one not to know, but what is
it? No. This is a technique by which you can make very precise cuts in the genome, like with a pair of scissors. For example, let's say you have a mutation and you want to cut that out and replace it with the right one, or you have too much of something and you only want to cut it out, then you can do a very precise cut and basically repair, if you will, the mutation. Mm-hmm. The exciting thing is that this is something that is now approved as a treatment for two types of blood diseases, thalassemia and sickle cell anemia. So for certain people with certain mutations, there is now a CRISPR-Cas-based system where they then self-correct and self-correct this defect that they have. So this is very exciting. I'm not aware of anything yet in the field of Parkinson's, but I would really predict that this is coming soon.
Excellent. I have two questions from people about their sisters. Yeah. Now, one is more of like a general question. Someone anonymously saying that I have an identical twin sister. I have PD, she doesn't. Why? And the second question is from David, who basically says he has had genetic screening because his sister has PD. He says also had PD, so I don't know whether he had it or not, but he basically says that he had none of the mutations. And is it likely that his sister and him have another genetic factor not yet found?
Yeah. Okay, so let's start with the twins. So this is, I think, also a very intriguing question. And we have followed, actually here, it's rare, of course, but we have followed 5 twin pairs and that were discordant. So one twin had it and one twin did not. They did not have any of the known mutations, but what we looked again into the mitochondrial function. So and into the mitochondrial genomes. And it was very interesting and very striking to see that the twin that had the disease had the problems with the energy metabolism with these little mitochondria, and the other twin did not. Now, of course, this doesn't really give you the actual answer, because it could also be just a secondary phenomenon, right? If you have the disease, maybe then your mitochondria don't work so well anymore. But this is definitely a difference that we could find in identical twins. And then I think coming back to the very good question we had before with the, you know, mutations that occur during the lifetime, the identical twins can, for example, grow up in very different environments, right? So it's possible that one was exposed to something, you know, that then later adds to mutations that may be predisposed, or it had a different environment that predisposes to PD. And it's, of course, I think it's important to note that not everything is in the genome as we inherit it, but there's the genome of mitochondria, there's changes in the genome over the lifetime, later mutations that we acquire, yes. And then there's the environment. Yeah.
So Johnny has a...
Yeah.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah.
Johnny has quite a long question. I'm just trying to extract the question from several sentences. I think that what he's basically asking is that, are there any specific symptoms or combination of symptoms that differentiate gene-positive PD from idiopathic PD? Or is there research that is being done specifically in this area? I think what he's basically talking about here is trying to detect through the symptoms those people who might have a genetic angle to their PD.
Yeah. The answer to this question is A qualified no, I would say. So, of course, if you have someone who gets Parkinson's, like my patient with a Parkinson mutation at the age of 13, then you will have all your genetic red flags raised, and you will think this has to be genetic. But when it comes to these people, as I showed you from the ROPAD study, where the ones with a mutation and those without, they differ by just by age of onset by 3, 4 years. Then it's becoming impossible to disentangle this, right? At least in an individual patient. So when you look
Yes.
at 13,000 patients, then yes, you get great p values, great statistics, but it doesn't help you in the individual patient. And so this is the problem. We're just too different.
I understand.
Yeah.
We are all unique. A great question from Anne. Anne is asking about the Parkin mutation, and she's asking if there is any gender imbalance related to the onset age. She says that her brother was diagnosed at age 21. She was diagnosed at 54, and her symptoms are improved by hormone replacement therapy more than the PD meds. But she wondered therefore if estrogens act as a protector for females. So there is a question about gender imbalance concerning the age and potential different reactions to hormone replacement therapy.
I see. This is a fascinating question. And the answer, in fact, I've asked myself that question before as well. And using this MDS gene tool that I mentioned, it's free on the web. You can, for example, filter for males or females. And I've done this for the different mutations, also for PINK and Parkin. And it turns out that the numbers of affected Parkin and PINK1 males and females, they do not differ. However, what you ask has been very well described, that there is that hormones or even menstrual cycle and things like this, they can have quite an impact on the expression of the symptoms. However, why this explains or how this might explain a difference in age of onset in the same family of what was like 30 years or something, it's hard. I have no good answer. But this is, again, if we understood what you did differently than your brother who had it so much earlier, this would be wonderful. So let's try to find out.
So, for anyone interested in pursuing the research or the information on women and Parkinson's, we had a great interview a few months ago. You can find the interview on our YouTube channel, and it talks a lot about the hormonal role. And it was touching on the topic of that hormones, understanding how hormones play a role for females, and also help you better understand PD for men. So it was not just about
Yeah,
female for
absolutely.
females, it was female
Yes.
for understanding generally.
Right. And there's actually another observation. Again, we don't have very, very good data, but it's very interesting. In European white people, as you know, Parkinson's is more common in men than women, right? It's about 1.5 to 1, that ratio, right? It's more common in men.
Yes.
In Asia, however, for example, in the Philippines, the ratio is equal. And we don't know why. So it's very interesting. So there's so many open questions that we need to study and learn more about.
So, a question from Missy. I don't know how familiar you are with the Biogen study, probably quite a bit.
Yes.
But she's basically saying that she has the LRRK2 mutation and did not
Right.
qualify for the Biogen study because she was outside of the 2-year onset requirement.
Exactly.
And Biogen apparently has changed their requirements, I think the parameters you mentioned. Could you give us a bit more details?
Yes, great question and very practical question. I only heard about this last week, as I said, that really, as you mentioned, unfortunately, so far the Biogen study this LUMA trial. It's called the LUMA trial, is very restricted, and only enrolls patients within the first 2 years of a disease. And most of the mutation carriers and the LRRK2 mutation carriers also have a slightly slower progression. So this is a little unfair, really. And so now Biogen has identified a need, and I don't know this for sure though. I think they will now allow for up to 5 years for LRRK2 mutation carriers. I
Okay,
don't know
that's
the
a big
exact
change.
details, but they're definitely opening it up.
So, Missy, I hope this works for you, but here is the answer to your question.
Hopefully.
So, a question from Kate and Roger. It's probably one of them that has PD, or maybe both, I don't know. But who are telling us that there is a history of a wide range of autoimmune disorders in their extended family, as well as PD. He or she has celiac disease, hypothyroidism, and lichen sclerosis, which I had never heard of. Are there any genetic studies looking at PD patients who have other autoimmune conditions in their family history? Now, I do realize that not everyone agrees that PD is an autoimmune disease, but basically, that still does not invalidate the question. Are there studies that look at the link between those conditions, for instance, autoimmune conditions and Parkinson's disease?
Thank you. This is also a fascinating and important question. And people do look indeed into comorbidities. In fact, it's not that a link has been very closely established. And it could be, of course, that this is a mere coincidence, right? That unfortunately you are struck by two diseases, that could happen. But what is also very interesting, and this is definitely a fact, so the LRRK2 gene, for example, has been implicated also in leprosy. Which is obviously an infectious disease, and also in chronic inflammatory bowel disease. So there are links to other diseases, and I think unfortunately we don't understand these very well. And unfortunately, also the researchers that do inflammatory diseases, for example, they don't talk too much to the neurologists, and vice versa, not because they don't like each other, but because they don't think about it, right? And so I think bridging these gaps and is really, really important. I don't have a definitive answer, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were such combinations, and at least in some people, and to understand how they come about would be very important, but really not much known yet, unfortunately.
Thank you, Christine. John says that he has had the Parkin gene for nearly 38 years. Would you believe this? And it has progressed slowly, which is great news. He's
Yeah.
asking if this will change as he gets older. He's now 51.
Typically not. So it's not with Parkinson's disease. It's typically not like with MS or other diseases where all of the sudden things can take off and become very bad. It's typically if you have a slow course, this is typically the tangent that you will remain on. Again, no promise in an individual case, but this is absolutely what we see. If you have had slow progression, it's really unlikely that all of a sudden it's getting really bad.
Thank you very much. Someone anonymously asking us what your thoughts around the genetics of progression as opposed to genetics of causation.
Yeah, great
And
question.
are there targets of interest that may allow for a slowing or a stopping of the progression?
Great question. So far, unfortunately, there are very few studies doing this well. There's one by Clemens Scherzer that came out a couple of years ago with some candidates, but there's nothing really very conclusive at this stage. So one hypothesis is, of course, that the genes that cause the disease may also influence the progression. But that does not necessarily have to be the case. So basically, a lot and mostly unknown, unfortunately. I think a great need for studies. As you know, most studies that you may have participated in, they're cross-sectional, or maybe they look maybe one or two more time points, and then after 2 years, everything's done. But this is not how we understand Parkinson's. Parkinson's can be a lifetime, especially in genetics forms. You're born with this, right? So we need to really, really start early and follow up for a long time. And this is, I think, one of the biggest unmet needs, because I think we could learn so much from the longitudinal. And these studies are just not being done yet. Yeah.
Thank you, Christine. The Dopamine Warriors Boxing Club has a specific question.
Yeah.
They received the RHOPAD gene test results in December 23. And they came back negative on 67 genes. I didn't know that test was so wide. But he's asking, or she's asking, would you know if the RAB32 gene would have been included in the RHOPAD gene test at that stage?
Yes, it was not at that stage.
It was not, okay.
The company is now revisiting these results, and they're looking back. But like I said, there's still validation work to be done, and I can also tell you that a few carriers have been found. But this is still very early days. I mean, we only learned about this like 2 months at the beginning of this year. So this is very, very recent, and too recent to. But I'm sure the company will reach out to you maybe in a few months or so if you have an additional, or not additional, but if you have the RAB32.
Thank you. And actually, the Dopamine Warriors Boxing Club is actually Jagdeep, with whom I've been in touch on other media. Thank you
Yeah.
for mentioning your name, Jagdeep. It's a pleasure talking to you. So I will just keep maybe just two or three questions maximum from what I already have. And Merco is basically saying that how is it possible to state that a gene or gene mutation is causing PD? What is the exact pathway that, how PD is developing in these persons? Is it maybe related to the cell power, the cell energy, human mitochondria, for instance?
Yes. Again, a very, very important question. The answer is we don't fully understand all of the processes in the recessive genes, parkin and PINK1. We probably understand it relatively well. What happens there is that the mitochondria cannot be cleared, I would say. So it's like the like if a mitochondrion gets old, it typically gets cleared through a process which is called mitophagy, from mito, and phagy means to eat. And so basically the old mitochondria are being eaten. That's what normally happens. And then like I said, a new mitochondrion is going to be born by just dividing. A bigger mitochondrion is dividing into two, and then they grow a little bit, and then you have two new ones. And this is the normal process. And in both parkin and PINK1, this process doesn't work. And that is relatively well established. And then what happens is that more and more of these old mitochondria accumulate, and they have a negative impact, as you can imagine. It's like the trash is not being removed, right? So they have a negative, yeah, it is like that, right? They need to be, they should be removed, but they're not. They're sitting there, they're disturbing the others, and the other mitochondria have to work, even harder. And so this is a process that is quite well understood for parkin and PINK1. Other genes work in different pathways. For example, LRRK2, as I said, LRRK2, it doesn't do too little. So in the recessive forms, there's too little. So there's not enough removal of the damaged mitochondria. But in LRRK2, there's too much activity. So too much activity of a LRRK2 stands for, the K stands for a kinase. So this is an enzyme, a protein that actually works on others. It starts lots of processes, and it does that too much. So this is another completely different concept. But as we learned from parkin and PINK, there are sometimes genes that work together, like parkin and PINK do that together in one pathway. LRRK2 and RAB32 work together in one pathway. So we're starting to understand a more complete picture, but I think we're still far from understanding every single step really well. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Christine. I will keep this last question from John because he hasn't asked any other questions, so I just want to give him the benefit of that. He's asking if you can comment on the recent findings by NIH published in Nature Genetics. No, I have no idea what those are, but you probably do.
Which are you talking about, the big the big GWAS study? Is that what you're talking about with the multi-ancestry GWAS?
Let's assume it is.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. So this is another wonderful effort. So again, now, branching out to many more populations. So as we haven't talked about this today, actually, almost at all, but it's not just these single genes that can, they have the high effects, they can give you the disease. But there's also, as we discussed, there's also combinations of risk factors. And interestingly, some of these genes, like for example, alpha-synuclein, it can work both as a cause and as a risk factor. And the same is true actually for LRRK2. So this study has aimed, and we knew this before, this has been shown already 10, 15 years ago, but only again in European whites. And so this study has now gone out and has done the same thing in the multi-ancestry, a big population, but actually, maybe not surprisingly, the same old suspects like alpha-synuclein show up again. But they also found some others with smaller effects. That are kind of new. What these mean, this is all at the risk factor level. So, for example, just to give you an impression, how many different things come together in one of the predecessor studies of this one, they built we call this a polygenic score, so many genes together, and this score consisted of almost 2,000 variants. So you really put together a lot of different things to try and get a more complete picture. And this has been done in this Nature Genetics paper as well, to a very nice extent. But as you can imagine, it's hard, again, in an individual to really say, to talk about all these different variants and to understand what they individually each do. And we already have problems understanding what LRRK2 does and parkin does and things, but all the more difficult, what do 2,000, variants together do, right? But an important, beautiful study. Yeah.
So, Christine, thank you very, very much, not only for your time today, because I know it is quite late in Germany. Well, it's like 10 o'clock. So, thank you very much for doing that after our privilege of talking to us. today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure. I just wished I could see you all and we could actually.
And thank you also for all the work you do, because actually for those 2 hours you're spending with us, you're spending basically your entire career helping us progress our understanding of genetics of Parkinson's. Yeah. And this is something really precious for all of us. So thank you very much.
I wished I could do more. I will try. So, but there are wonderful colleagues out there, as I showed you, the clinician scientists. They really enjoy this, and they really, you know, work towards this. They make it their, you know, their. It's close to our hearts. So that's for sure. And I would also like to thank you, because as I said, this is only possible together, and it's not just the research, but it's also the inspiration and the goal that we have. And so all of that is really. And you also sit there, you know, late at night, and so listen to what I have to say. And so this is a give and take, and really enjoyable and wonderful and an inspiration. So thank you.
And if you want any of us to donate our brains, we'd be happy to, but you need to give us the instructions. So heartbreaking, yeah. There, but actually also to our audience, I wanted everyone to know that our next session will be taking place on the 22nd of April, and we'll be delighted to host Dr. Michelle Sexton on the topic of cannabis and Parkinson's, which is an interesting one that you don't very often hear about. So that would be great. 22nd of April, the invitations will follow shortly. Wow. Thank you very much, Christine. Thank you, everyone, for joining
us. Thank
you.
Have a wonderful evening, everyone, and hope to see you all.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.